Exactly. Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Molly Wheeler, and I will be the host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, and is co-sponsored by the Departments of Political Science and Sociology. Charlene Orchard will be introducing our speaker.
Hi, welcome. So, May 8th, 2010, the political landscape in our country experienced a real jolt. And journalists from throughout the country came here to the great state of Utah to report on the matter. The next day, Sunday, May 9th, 2010, a Deseret News story read, "Reporters for national media outlets descended on state Republican convention Saturday, smelling blood in Utah's Senate race." And the New York Times reported on the bloodbath. Senator Robert F. Bennett, an 18-year veteran Republican who had been seeking a fourth term, was stripped of his party's nomination on Saturday at the state convention here, becoming one of the first congressional victims of the surging discontent from the Tea Party-infused Republican right. 5 years later, the Tea Party is still a force to be reckoned with. Many associated with the Tea Party movement are formidable organizers, and they are passionate about their causes. It's important to know, though, that no one group represents the Tea Party or speaks for them. They do not speak with one voice. We can't paint all of the Tea Parties with one brush, say, for example, they're all like the Koch brothers. It's a much more complex and complicated story than that. And to help us understand this complicated picture, we are very fortunate to have Professor Theda Scotchpole here to share her insights from her research on the Tea Party, research that was initiated by two of her graduate students, one of whom, Vanessa Williamson, went on to co-author with Professor Scotchpole, The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, which was published in 2012. I could quite literally spend the rest of our time here listing Theda's accomplishments, awards, articles, and books. It's an amazing list of accomplishments. So I'll just hit on a few of the highlights. She is the Victor S. Thomas Professor of Government and Sociology at Harvard University, where she has also served as a dean. Her work covers a broad spectrum of topics, including both comparative politics, as with states and social revolutions in 1979, and American politics, protecting soldiers and mothers, the political origins of social policy in the United States, 1993. But her research also crosses disciplines, drawing on sociology and history. And this interdisciplinary approach gives her work unusual depth and a real richness. Her books and articles have been widely cited in political science literature and have won numerous awards, including the 1993 Woodrow Wilson Award of the American Political Science Association for the best book in political science for the previous year. In 2007, she was awarded the Johann Skytte Prize in Political Science for her visionary analysis of the significance of the state for revolution, welfare, and political trust, pursued with theoretical depth and empirical evidence. The Skytte Prize is one of the largest and most prestigious in political science and is awarded annually to a scholar who has made the most valuable contribution to the discipline. I want to take just a minute to thank Professor Tabitha Benny for bringing such world-renowned scholars here to meet with us and to engage in conversations with faculty and students alike. And on behalf of all of the graduate students, I would like to thank you, Theda, for all of the time that you are spending with us. And now please welcome me, join me in welcoming Theda to our talk. Thank you.
And let me turn on my mic, the one that allows me to wander around. It's a great pleasure for me to be at the University of Utah. This is my first visit over a long career to this university, and I'm enjoying meeting many faculty and graduate students and seeing the vibrancy of what's going on here. So thank you for inviting me. I'm going to talk about something that has burst on the scene during the presidency of Barack Hussein Obama, in a way that has changed agendas and the way in which we think about American politics in our time. I think we'll all remember that it was just a few weeks after Obama had moved into the White House in January of 2009 that a rant, what came to be known as a rant, occurred on CNBC, commentator Rick Santelli, invoking the founding fathers, no less, to denounce the mortgage assistance policies of the Obama administration, which was one sliver of the various things that that administration was scrambling to do to deal with the deepest economic crisis since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Within days, a buzz spread through the previously demoralized ranks of American conservatives in and to the right of the Republican Party. Understandably, they were demoralized, just as liberals were demoralized in 2000 when the rare occurrence of a presidency and both houses of Congress being in the hands of the same party occurred. So within a few weeks, there was a response to Santelli's call to hold Tea Party demonstrations in various regions with older white people dressed up as colonial protesters throwing tea bags in that early stage to symbolize what they were about. By summer, there were regional and then national demonstrations in the fall. And over the following year, hundreds of local Tea Parties were formed. And Tea Party forces of various kinds that I'll discuss became a force in the run-up to the 2010 midterm elections, when Democrats suffered the greatest defeats at the state and national level that they had in decades, partly infused by the energy and determination of Tea Party forces to oppose Democrats and the Obama agenda. So as all this was unfolding, Vanessa Williamson, my partner in this research that I'm going to be talking about, was, I think she was at that stage, a second-year graduate student. She was taking a Robert Putnam seminar and was interested in the question of social capital among protesters for and against the health reform bill, which was being debated endlessly at that stage. Vanessa quickly discovered that the pro-health reform people didn't have very much social capital, but that the anti-health reform people had plenty of both energy and social connections. And so she then got to know the head of the New England Regional Tea Party at that point and eventually sent out an email questionnaire with the cooperation of the local Tea Party leader as well as visiting various local Tea Party meetings. I, meanwhile, was working with historical sociologists and political scientists on a volume about what was happening in the first 2 years of the Obama presidency. An interesting kind of moment because every once in a while a president comes along who's trying to change the direction of what the U.S. federal government does, not an easy thing to do. And so we were interested in what would happen, what would play out in the various attempts to change the direction of policy for healthcare, immigration, labor rights, and global warming and environmentalism, you name it. But it was hard to miss the fact that this Tea Party eruption, whatever it was capturing a lot of the national agenda and creating forces that were putting severe brakes on what was possible, even with a president and both houses of Congress in Democratic hands. So Vanessa and I teamed up and asked the question, not how do we label the Tea Party. We spent no time trying to decide whether it was a social movement or a manipulation of the Koch brothers or any of the things that people were claiming. We just ignored all that and simply threw every empirical method known to the social sciences at the problem. We put together surveys that looked at over time, that asked Americans whether they knew what the Tea Party was, which mostly they didn't at first, and then whether they supported it or didn't. Eventually, more detailed questions about what kind of support. So we used that data. Vanessa did an analysis of news coverage of Tea Party events on CNN and Fox so that we could compare the timing of the coverage and the nature of the coverage on the two cable networks. We looked at what was going on with various organizations that were saying they were part of the Tea Party on the national scale. We certainly looked at politicians and what was happening in primaries to people like Senator Bennett here in Utah. But we also took the additional step of deepening our engagement with actual grassroots people who called themselves Tea Partiers by visiting and observing Tea Party meetings, not public protests, but actual meetings of Tea Parties in three regions of the United States, various places in New England, Arizona, and Virginia, various parts of Virginia. And we sat down for face-to-face, confidential, open-ended interviews with Tea Party leaders and participants at the local level in as many of those settings as we could persuade people that it was safe to talk to people from Harvard University, which is a challenge in Tea Party world, since Harvard University is not a favorable category in that world. So here are some of the things that we found out and wrote up in the book that was first published in 2011, a revised version in 2012. You'll notice that we did not allow any dust to settle in this research. We moved extremely fast, putting together these sources of evidence so that we could get a book out while people still cared about the phenomenon, not 10 years later. So we discovered, first of all, that the Tea Party, even though I will refer to it as the Tea Party, media refer to it as the Tea Party, everybody refers to it as the Tea Party, is not one thing. It is, in fact, a congeries of top-down and bottom-up organizations, loosely connected to one another, that have situated themselves overlapping the rightward edge of the Republican Party, and have, as a field of organizations, gained enormous leverage over the agenda and large parts of the office-holding membership of the Republican Party, shoving it so sharply to the right that political science majors can barely keep up, are the most quantitative ones, over the last 8 years. But it has both a top-down and a bottom-up component. Let me start with the grassroots activism. Although at the time we launched this research, and even more today, there are people who say this is all just an illusion created by the Koch brothers, that is not true. Peaking in 2010 and 11, but still there, what we estimate to be about 250,000 very active volunteer Tea Party participants and members founded over the course of 2009 and 2010 up to 1,000 local Tea Parties meeting in every single state of the United States. And I think, you know, pretty dense on the ground here in Utah, but not the densest here. They met in those places to plan activities, learn about issues, monitor Republican candidates and office holders, and of course oppose Barack Obama and Democrats. So that's one component of the Tea Party universe. A second component, which was especially important at the very beginning, is right-wing media cheerleading. It is pretty important. Protest movements happen among disgruntled people pretty regularly in the United States, but they usually have difficulty in getting a powerful sense of themselves as a force together very quickly because of communication difficulties. In the case of the Tea Party in 2009 and 2010, Fox News was out in front of all other news outlets. They weren't so much covering as they were promoting the Tea Party. And we showed this empirically by looking at the patterns and timing of coverage And telling people where to go and telling people that if they were part of the Tea Party, it was a really important thing to be part of. So that right-wing cheerleading, which also extended to talk radio, if anything at the local level, more important. And in fact, talk radio MCs are often part of the leadership of local Tea Parties. And then the third part of it is the money and ideal-wielding elites who, frankly, didn't organize for the first time in 2009 and 2010. They were there all along in various kinds of conservative Republican political action committees, think tanks with glossy offices and large professional staffs in Washington, D.C. or elsewhere. And when the eruptions from below burst out in the early Obama presidency, many of these elite groups like Freedom Works, Americans for Prosperity, and eventually the Tea Party Patriots, which were sort of created as an umbrella group, Tea Party Express, and now, by now, we've got, my goodness, we have the Senate Conservative Action Fund and Heritage Action and all kinds of fairly powerful and resourceful groups calling themselves Tea Party leaders. So they also jumped on the bandwagon and tried to leverage the protests. Let me say a little bit more now about each of these three components, but particularly about the grassroots Tea Partiers, because that's really where Vanessa and I learned really important and moving new things in our work. And some of you may know that over the course of my career, I'm known as a historical institutionalist, that I look at the big picture, that I study things organizationally. All of this is true. This is the first time in my career that I have ever done face-to-face interviews with grassroots civic activists. I've done face-to-face interviews with big-deal policymakers, but these are ordinary folks that we were interviewing. And it was both a wrenching experience and an extremely informative experience. And it was informative about the complex, often personally appealing qualities of the people that we sat down with, who we would not have run across in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I can assure you. It was revealing about how the Tea Party was organized from below. So it was conducive to the structural analysis that we offer in our book about the competing fields of organizations in the Tea Party. And what we discovered from both our interviews and observations and from correlating them with available surveys, nationally representative surveys, about up to 3 in 10 Americans at the height of this phenomenon around 2010 and 11 expressed sympathy with the Tea Party. A smaller proportion, maybe 15% to 20% at the height, said they had done something concrete to support the Tea Party, like sending money or attending a rally or attending a meeting. And as I said below, a core of about 250,000, we estimate, were active participants in Tea Parties that met once a month and sometimes as often as once a week in about 900 to 1,000 locations around the United States at the high point. We did determine with some pretty careful triangulation that all three categories of people, the couch potato sympathizers, the somewhat active sympathizers, and the activists, are broadly similar in the characteristics that I'm about to discuss, although I strongly suspect that the really active ones are more disproportionately toward women than the couch potatoes. And there's nothing surprising about that because women have always done the basic work in American social movements, even if they've not been the public face of those movements. So who are these people? They are conservative-minded Americans who, if they vote for one of the two political parties, have always voted for Republicans. They do not vote for Democrats. They may not, and from the beginning often did not, call themselves Republicans because they're very skeptical of the Republican Party establishment, such as it is and was. They are people who have hated and feared Barack Obama and who share a determination, as they say it, to take their country back from Democrats. Tea Party people demographically tend to be middle-class whites. Because they are somewhat older than Americans in general, 45 and above and often 60 and above, they are also somewhat more economically comfortable and better educated. Let me say that again. Also better educated than the median American. At least half of them are socially conservative Christians, as well as Tea Party sympathizers, and may have been active in the Christian right before and still at the same time. Although there are also people who had some previous affinity with libertarianism. And contrary to public stereotypes, we found that the attitudes Tea Partiers had about the role of government in American society were much more complex than the public stereotypes would suggest. And this is where we really learned a lot, by sitting down and talking to people. Our way of talking to people was extremely respectful of their evident commitment to democratic, small d, citizen activism, and it was very gentle. The interview consisted of saying, "Tell us about yourself and how you learned about the Tea Party." And the answers to those questions told us a great deal about one of our research questions, which was, were these pre-existing groups that simply relabeled themselves, or were they newly formed groups where people got together for the first time in the heat of the moment in 2009? And overwhelmingly, it's the latter. They met for the first time and often used very creative techniques like meetup, or writing to people who wrote letters to the editor to the local newspaper to find other like-minded people and form local tea parties. We also asked people to tell us, what the Tea Party meant to them and how they felt about things like government spending or health care reform or any of the issues that they brought up as being what the Tea Party was about. And eventually, if people didn't bring it up, we would ask our interviewees about Social Security, Medicare, and veterans benefits. Because I will admit that going in, we did have one suspicion. And one of those suspicions was that a bunch of Americans in their 60s were unlikely to be completely opposed to Medicare, Social Security, and military veterans benefits. That turned out to be very, very true. So what we found about their views from just listening to people and taking notes: Tea Party people at the grassroots oppose taxes and regulations on business. We had a fair number of liberals who said to us, well, really, they're just like the left. They don't like Wall Street. That's not what we found. What we found is that left and right alike didn't like the bailouts associated with either the Bush or the Obama administration, but the left blamed Wall Street and the right blamed the Democrats. I mean, basically they blamed the Democrats for everything that happened, no matter what. We found that Tea Partiers who were very much against taxes and regulation no matter what also, in many cases, favored draconian government steps to block illegal immigration. And in fact, in our view, the single issue that most passionately engages Tea Party people in all regions of the United States, no matter how many immigrants there are in those regions, is the idea that there are too many immigrants crashing into America and that most of them are illegal and should be sent home. Socially conservative Tea Partiers, and that's not all of them, also pretty passionate about government acting to shut down abortion provision and to reinforce traditional conceptions of marriage and sexuality. When it comes to spending, although they call for big cuts in federal spending, many Tea Partiers collect benefits from Social Security, Medicare, and, say, TRICARE, health care for veterans, or are about to, and like almost all Americans, in this sense, they are not different from anybody else except for 10% of people who live in New York and at the top there. Tea Party people believe that Americans have earned those benefits from lifetime of hard work and that there's nothing at all wrong about them collecting those benefits. They know they are government benefits, so that famous phrase that you may have heard that people often make fun of Tea Partiers by saying, they say, don't put the government's hands on my Medicare. That really means don't put Barack Obama's hands on my Medicare. It does not mean that they don't know it's a government program. They know. On the other hand, they're very much against welfare programs. And they think of welfare programs pretty broadly as any government program or spending, taxpayer spending, supported spending, that goes for things like Medicaid, food stamps, and, startled us, Pell Grants for low-income college students. All of these are seen as welfare, going to moochers and freeloaders. We were, of course, all ears. We wanted to know who the moochers and the freeloaders were. And these interviews were conducted in early 2011, and it was far long before Mitt Romney talked about, you know, moochers and freeloaders with the tinkling of the luncheon service in Boca Raton. In our face-to-face interviewers, people told us that the moochers and the freeloaders were low-income people who thought they should get something for nothing, often who didn't want to work. And they often gave the example of young people in their own families. So this means it wasn't just a racial thing. They would invoke grandnieces and nephews or grandsons or daughters who were, they said, not getting jobs, not moving out of their parents' homes, expected to get a grant and maybe even some food stamps to go to college, and just weren't doing it like we did it when we worked our way up in the past. So that's who grassroots Tea Partiers are. And I think it's possible to understand, given all of this, why Barack Obama is indeed the devil incarnate in grassroots Tea Party land. It's not simply his black skin, and I'm not even sure it's mainly his black skin. I think it's its middle name. We certainly found anger and fear of Muslims to be universal among grassroots Tea Partiers, even though they didn't know any. And we also found that symbolizes foreignness and immigrants coming into the United States, and it was also a big minus that millions of young people liked Barack Obama. As one lady put it to us, her niece had gone to Washington to participate in that big demonstration yelling, "Obama, Obama, Obama." And you could hear the fear in her voice when she thought about this kind of generational change going on that was leading to an America that was not one she recognized. And so I would say fear lies behind the anger. Now, let me say a little bit more about elites on the Tea Party bandwagon, and quickly, so that we can open the discussion. There was a powerful grassroots component in the early phases of the Tea Party upsurge and leading into the huge victories that ultra-conservative Republicans achieved in the primaries and the general election in 2010. And you can see that in many ways that energy infused an electorate that, because it was a midterm electorate, was going to be smaller, whiter, and older than the electorates are in presidential years. So in many ways, that's what happened. But from the start of this phenomenon, there were also top-down groups that said, hey, this is great. I think as one Koch-backed group said, finally the troops have arrived. I mean, the generals had been there fighting for privatization of Social Security and Medicare, the very programs that the troops are on, and working for a deregulation and extreme reductions in taxation, particularly on business. Both ideological think tanks and advocacy groups and funding groups disgruntled with the Bush administration, disgruntled with the losing McCain campaign, and disgruntled with Karl Rove's operation, which was closely identified with those Republican establishments leading into the 2008 election. All of those groups were heartened and immediately energized into full action by the popular component of the Tea Party. And they increasingly put themselves in front of the cameras to announce that they were speaking for the Tea Party. Now, in our research, we didn't really find that early on the grassroots Tea Party groups knew much about these elites that were speaking for them, and they certainly hadn't selected them. They sometimes resented them, and they weren't getting checks from them. Let me say that again. Grassroots Tea Party groups were not getting checks from the Koch brothers. They were run like the Methodist Church, I remember, from my youth. People would make contributions, and ladies would bring baked goods. And then there was the added component, of course, that there would be a literature table and a table where you could buy a nice little Tea Party pin made in China or a pocket constitution, and the proceeds from that would go to the group. But most local Tea Party groups were shoestring operations, and they depended on volunteer energy and contributions. The most that they got from some of these top-down groups in the early months were buses that were sometimes deployed to take people to Washington for big demonstrations. But in Virginia, they carpooled. I mean, they're all very close. So the top-down groups were not controlling the bottom-up groups, and the bottom-up groups certainly didn't elect or weren't necessarily loyal to the top groups. As time passed, though, and all of the media got interested in covering the Tea Party, which inevitably happened once it became politically successful, and once large numbers of Tea Party-identified Republicans were in Congress, then the momentum shifted to the top-down groups. So you had, after the 2010 election, Dick Armey, you know, a lobbyist and former Republican Party leader presenting himself as an insurgent, and speaking for the insurgency against John Boehner. And you had the Koch brothers arriving with their grassroots operation, Americans for Prosperity, which has enormously expanded with Tea Party people on their mailing lists and with federated organizations in many of the states, and is now almost a shadow Republican Party. They don't put themselves forward publicly that much, although Tim Phillips does to some degree. But you had all of these groups getting more attention for their agenda, which is not exactly the same agenda as grassroots passion in the Tea Party. And a couple of the things at the back of the room, which were written by Vanessa and I more recently than the book, the revised edition of which appeared after the 2012 election and had an afterword about the 2012 election. This phenomena of the shift of leverage and initiative within the Tea Party universe toward the more money and idea-driven groups, professionally organized, has continued apace. So let me conclude by just saying, what has been the impact of all of this on the Republican Party? It's really hard to remember, but it's just less than 8 years ago that John McCain, you know, he wasn't sincere about this, but he sort of endorsed cap and trade. You had Republican politicians who were prepared sometimes to talk about using taxes as well as spending cuts. Not very often, but occasionally, to move toward a balanced budget. And there were moderate conservatives, certainly, still in the House of Representatives and the Senate. I think there's basically one or two now left in the Senate. So the Republican Party has really moved startlingly to the right if we measure it by what people vote for and what the agendas are that emerged particularly in Republican presidential primaries, where the race always seems to be to see who can be the furthest to the right, who can be the toughest. That was certainly a big factor in 2012. All the journalists were writing about how the Tea Party was being defeated by yet another mainstream Republican candidate, And by the way, when we interviewed Tea Partiers in 2011 and asked them who their candidate for president was, not a one of them liked Mitt Romney. This was one area of close agreement between Cambridge liberals and Tea Partiers. That Mitt Romney, as one lady said to me, is not to be trusted. You don't know what he stands for. So that was not their candidate. And in the 2012 Republican primaries, we saw this phenomenon of one non-Romney after another, you know, peaking in the Republican polls as the 50 to 60% of very conservative-minded Republicans who will tell pollsters that they sympathize with the Tea Party were desperately looking for a non-Romney. But the other dynamic that was going on was that as those debates played out and as candidates competed for the votes of Tea Party-minded Republicans who are very good citizens, they vote, they pay attention, they send emails, they send monetary contributions, they're very, very good citizens by any participatory definition that political scientists would ever use. As the candidates competed for their, at least, acquiescence, all of them, including Mitt Romney, as you saw, moved steadily to the right on all of the major issues. Romney, in particular, took a hard line about immigrants and talked about self-deportation by the end of the primary season, and he selected as his vice president Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, who's really a dream candidate from the perspective of advocates on the far right who want to roll back not just the Great Society but the New Deal as well. The progressive era, if they could get back there, they'd go for that too. So that same dynamic has certainly played out in the Congress, and only now could you argue that McConnell and Boehner, who really espouse the same policies as more conservative Republicans, only now are they beginning to get any kind of handle on how to deal with the no compromise ever kick-ass stance of very conservative Republicans. I think it's beginning to happen, but with great difficulty, and it's happening in the House of Representatives only by John Boehner accepting votes from Nancy Pelosi and her Democratic caucus. And it remains to be seen what will happen in the 2016 primaries. But we've just seen someone who thrills grassroots Tea Partiers. That's Ted Cruz of Texas. He thrills them both for his smarts, and he is smart, for his no-compromise stance toward Obama and Obama's policies, and for his hard line on immigration. And he, if he is a presence in the Republican primaries, and the Republicans are of many stripes are doing all they can to prevent that, he will create some of the same dynamics of issue competition to the right for the primaries leading into whatever will happen in 2016. So bottom line is that this not one thing Tea Party, but universe of jostling bottom-up and top-down organizations devoted to both pulling the Republican Party to the right, preventing it from compromising with Democrats in a period where the stakes seem very high about the role of government in American society, and promoting a very, very far-right agenda on many key policies, particularly health care and immigration and any response to global warming through government. That way of thinking about the Tea Party, it has been very, very successful and continues to be very successful as a leveraging operation, not as a label or as a popularity contest, because all that I've described here since 2010 has been unfolding as the Tea Party label has become less and less popular with most Americans and even with many Republicans who earlier said that they were sympathetic to the Tea Party. It's less popular. And the Washington, D.C. press punditry has declared the Tea Party dead at least a dozen times in the last several years. And they have not been effective, usually, in electing their own candidates in primaries in the most recent primary contests. But that's not all that counts for a social movement loosely organized using passion, ideas, and money to pull one of America's two major parties into a more extreme policy stance and into a non-compromising stand. Those have been the real goals that are shared, and on those criteria, the Tea Party has not only been very successful, it is still quite effective. Let me stop there.
We will be devoting the remainder of our time to questions. If you have a question, please state your name and a little information about yourself into the mic, and then briefly state your question. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lisa Roche. I'm a reporter with the Deseret News and KSL here in Salt Lake City. I'm interested in your assessment of our Senator Mike Lee, who's running for re-election in 2016. He stood with Ted Cruz in the fight against the Affordable Care Act that led to the government shutdown. It was hit pretty hard in the polls here because of that, and it has been seen since as moderating his stance in preparation for his re-election campaign. At one time, there were a lot of Republicans that were going to run against him. Now they all seem to have joined his campaign. I'm wondering what you make of that in terms of your assessment of the Tea Party's continued strength. Thank you.
Well, I did notice that Senator Lee refused to endorse Ted Cruz for president, which I take to mean that he's very pragmatically keeping his options open among the various conservative contenders for the Republican nomination. You know, I have to say that in our research, we found both grassroots and elite Tea Party forces to be very pragmatic. For example, you know, the issue came up in our research about whether anger at the Republican Party would lead to third-party efforts. And those have happened here or there. And every once in a while, especially in the 2012 contest, there were some rather odd Senate candidates that were labeled Tea Party, but I think were actually simply extreme on some longstanding Christian right issues. In general, I think Tea Party people of all stripes are quite pragmatic about what the goal is. And I would be very surprised, you know more than I do about Senator Lee's latest stands, but I would be very surprised if Senator Lee is actually moderating on any of the major policy issues of the day. He may be getting a little bit more practical about what tactics one wants to use when handed into a presidential contest. Remember, 3 out of 5 Americans vote in presidential candidate contests, and in mid-year elections, 2 out of 5 vote. That's really the main thing you need to know about American politics in some ways. It's very, very simple. That's what I say when I go to Europe. And, you know, the Europeans then become less puzzled about how one country can do all these different things. It's not the same electorate. So if Senator Lee has to be reelected in 2016, he will almost certainly become more practical about the tactics he follows. But he's still a very tough-minded, extreme conservative, and I'm sure he still supports the basic agenda that I have described here today.
Hi, my name is Lee Nasruddin. I'm a professor in the political science department. Thank you for your talk. I was wondering if you could say something about how Tea Party affiliates think about common goods and if there is any space for collective goods and common goods in the Tea Party platform. I don't know if we should call it that, but approach.
Well, there isn't a platform because there's not one thing. But You know, when let me just describe some of my experiences in attending meetings in Virginia and also in Maine. First of all, at the grassroots, Tea Party volunteers are really very, very savvy and committed citizens. I mean, they believe in pitching in and working together. The woman who led the Virginia Tea Party group she had previously orchestrated community theater events in Charlottesville, Virginia. She knew how to get people to do things and to work with others, and really a lovely person. I mean, I used to have to go home and take a Tylenol after these interviews because the tension between such admirable qualities. And in the meetings that we attended, we observed grassroots Tea Party people working very hard to overcome a division which, from the outside, people would think would have been debilitating, which is the division between people who believe in Christian conservative cultural priorities and libertarian-minded or more secular-minded people. And that could come down to things like a fight about whether God or Jesus should be mentioned in opening prayers. I mean, one of the things we observed was whether meetings opened with a Pledge of Allegiance, which they always did, or a prayer, sometimes did. And did the prayer mention Jesus or not? And there are Jewish Tea Partiers. I mean, they're mainly Russian immigrants, but there are some. So they were working hard to overcome those divisions, and I think quite successfully, because they were prepared to see themselves as patriots together who were trying to take their country back. So in that sense, they saw a common good. They see themselves as fighting for the true America, and they are willing to work with people, including establishment Republicans, if those people will get on board with the cause. But when it came to Democrats or freeloaders and moochers, the level of bile and hatred expressed was off the scale and far disproportionate to any human reality one suspected that people were experiencing in their daily lives. So I'm not going to give you an answer because I don't know how to put all this together, except to say that all politics is about who we are and who they are at some level. I said that in at Harvard, and somebody got up very huffy and said, "Not here. We don't think that way." Well, right there, you can start laughing. Because of course they think that way. And, you know, as one of the Tea Party women that I interviewed said to me, she said, "Where you come from, they think we're a bunch of ignorant, racist rednecks." Well, what was I going to say to that? I said, not all of us think that way. That's all I could say. So let's be clear. A big force in politics is not economic self-interest. None of these things that we all analyze all the time in our highly quantitative data sets. It's a sense of who we are and who they are. So with the we, the Tea Partiers are prepared to think about the common good. But when it's the they, I mean, the one Tea Party meeting I attended incognito, mostly I went, these are public meetings, so you have the right to go incognito. Most of the meetings I attended, I was known to at least the organizer of the meeting, and my mission was clear. And certainly in the interviews, we followed all the human subjects rules, introduced ourselves, were clear about who we are, what we were doing, et cetera. No secrets whatsoever. In fact, the questions handed to people in advance, just to build trust, because that had to be done. But the one meeting I attended in Maine, it was just too tempting, so I stripped the Obama stickers off my car and and drove up to the community center in York, Maine, where the cars were all these large things with things like "Keep working, my welfare depends on it," or the Tea Party bumper stickers. The purpose of the meeting was for a New Hampshire Tea Party leader, a big deal guy, to come to Maine and tell the Maine people how to take over the local Republican Party. He cited Saul Alinsky. He ran down the principles that that can be used to take over Republican parties, which, you know, absolutely they've done in lots of places. And then he talked about Democrats. And Democrats, I'm sitting there taking notes. People take notes in Tea Party meetings, so it didn't seem unusual. People take notes in Tea Party meetings. He described Democrats as a coalition of liberal college professors. Racial minorities, illegal immigrants, who are going to be the voters of the future as soon as Obama can get them legalized, government officials who are taking our taxpayer money to support themselves lavishly. That's who the Democratic Party are. And they are seen as the embodiment of evil. And you don't compromise with the embodiment of evil. So on the tolerance front, you know, they wouldn't pass. But from their perspective, that's how they see the world. And it's important to understand that that's what they see. Yes? Right there.
It was an excellent talk, and you've essentially given a prescription on how to organize grassroots and take over a party. Do you see any kind of future for such a movement in the Democratic Party, but with a different agenda?
Well, let's think about Occupy Wall Street, because back when that was the thing, I was often asked about that. How does that compare? Now, I want you to take what I'm saying here with a little bit of a grain of salt, because they haven't actually done the same kind of research, although some of my students have done research on Occupy Wall Street. Some similarities. In both cases, people who were prepared to use, obviously, public demonstrations, labeling, to distance themselves from but push their side of the spectrum. We know that Occupy Wall Street people, mainly white, just like the Tea Partiers, mainly white, but younger, usually not college students for the most part, but people, young adults, at the beginning of their often uncertain work careers, were the major supporters and paraders in the Occupy Wall Street things. But think about the difference. From the beginning, the Tea Party forces, grassroots and top-down, were leveraging the Republican Party. They weren't saying we won't have anything to do with it. They were saying we don't like it the way it is. We're going to push it. We're going to elect our people, or just as good as electing your own people is getting the ones already there to do what you want. I mean, that's really more cost-efficient if you think about it. But the Occupy Wall Street demonstrators told the surveys that I've seen that they thought electoral politics was dirty and they weren't going to have anything to do with it. They were going to stick with the initial tactic, which was building tent cities in the center of cities, headed into winter. It's not a good tactic for the long run. And we know that social movements have to innovate. In the Tea Party case, they started with big regional demonstrations, and then they moved to these permanent Tea Party organizations that were operating on a much more dispersed and a much more persistent. That's the word I would use, persistent. They don't quit. And they don't quit when they lose either. So I think there's a big difference. There's also, I suspect, a big difference in the elite forces on the edges of the two parties, and I'm just beginning to do some research on that. I'm particularly interested in how the wealthy Democratic leaning donors compare to the Koch operation and the other various operations that have been put together to the right of the Republican Party. But I can tell you right now that persistence is definitely a difference. And centralized focus on the task at hand, which is electing people to office and making sure that they do what you want when they're there. So I don't see anything comparable on the Democratic Party side. Now, arguably, that can't happen. Democrats are more likely to be supported, not entirely, but more likely to be supported by middle and lower income people. They have a more racially diverse and younger coalition. Their big money people are very much there, but they're all conflicted about having a lot of money and using it. You have the phenomenon of the Democracy Alliance funding groups to get big money out of politics. I mean, this is not a conflict of principle that you're going to see, I suspect, at a Koch seminar, where the billionaires are perfectly unconflicted about the alignment of their moral purpose, which I think is intense. I think there's intense moral purpose there with economic interests. They don't perfectly line up, but they mostly line up. And people are not conflicted. So those are some of the differences I see.
That actually concludes the time we have for questions. Please join me in thanking our speaker.
Thank you all. Good questions.